A U.S. attack on a boat off the coast of Venezuela killed 11 people. Venezuela's response so far has been muted.
They don't want an escalation. The Venezuelan armed forces are in no shape to confront this task force, much less anything else the U.S. might send.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the reaction from Latin America and beyond. Plus, flooding on the border of Pakistan and India is partly due to infrastructure that will continue to be tested.
Climate change is a threat multiplier.
In England, new rules require hospitals to let patients get second opinions when providers dismiss their concerns. Why one family fought so hard for the change.
What we felt was that we were completely powerless when we were in hospital.
Plus, a swim on London's River Thames. That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We begin today in Latin America, where U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is wrapping up a trip to the region. Today, he is in Ecuador. Yesterday, he was in Mexico. But the big question South American leaders are asking right now is what the United States is doing off the coast of Venezuela. The Pentagon recently sent a small fleet of warships to the southern Caribbean. And on Tuesday, President Trump boasted on social media that U.S. forces had carried out a direct attack on a ship there, killing 11, quote, narco-terrorists. The announcement has raised a lot of questions. It's also sparked a wide range of reactions in Latin America and beyond. The World's Matthew Bell kicks things off today with our report.
President Trump's social media post included a short, grainy video of the nighttime strike with no sound. It shows a small, fast boat cutting through the waves. There are several passengers on board and some sort of cargo. Suddenly, the vessel is engulfed in a fireball. Trump's post said the boat was transporting illegal drugs and that the people on board were members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Agua. Venezuela's communications minister responded in a social media post of his own, saying the video was fake, created by AI, without providing any evidence. The Venezuelan government has mostly kept quiet about this incident, but on Wednesday, during a World War II commemoration ceremony, President Nicolas Maduro said this.
Hoy el imperialismo lanza una embestida nueva.
Imperialism is launching a new attack, Maduro said. It's not the first or the last, but Venezuela will stand with strong faith in victory and in peace. Maduro's government has good reason to downplay this recent U.S. attack. That's according to Phil Gunson of the International Crisis Group. He spoke with me from the Venezuelan capital, Caracas.
The reason why the Venezuelan government is pretending that this is artificial intelligence, and they know it's not, is because they don't want an escalation. I mean, they're really seriously seeking to avoid an escalation for obvious reasons. You know, the Venezuelan armed forces are in no shape to confront this task force, much less anything else the U.S. might send.
The Russian foreign ministry said today that the United States is putting blatant pressure on Venezuela by deploying U.S. warships. But Gunson says the response from other parts of Latin America is mixed.
A lot of regional governments, including Argentina, Ecuador, governments that are aligned with the Trump administration, were very quick to support this move. Of course, on the other hand, the biggest governments in the region, Colombia, Mexico, Brazil, all of them led by left-leaning presidents, have come out very firmly against any intervention, any violation of sovereignty, which is a very sensitive issue to them. But of course, there's not a lot they can do. I mean, you know, Trump is flexing U.S. military power, and nobody's in a hurry to challenge him on that front.
The prime minister of Trinidad and Tobago, where that suspected drug boat was heading, has come out with enthusiastic praise for the U.S. military presence. Kamla Persad Bassesser said, "The pain and suffering the cartels have inflicted on our nation is immense. I have no sympathy for traffickers. The U.S. military should kill them all violently." Experts say that Venezuela is used by Latin American drug gangs as a transit point for illegal shipments of cocaine, marijuana. But Chris Dalby says gang members from Tren de Aragua are not the major players here. Dalby writes about organized crime and spent many years reporting in Latin America.
Tren de Aragua is, again, a real criminal gang, a real threat to the United States. However, they do not do cocaine trafficking in this way. They never have. They don't compete with the Mexicans and the Colombians in international cocaine trafficking. They don't have the firepower or the resources to do so.
Dolby says that some Latin American leaders are probably alarmed by the Trump administration's use of language like narco-terrorism to describe this president's goals in the region.
In using the vocabulary from the war on terror in the war on drugs, he's creating a forever enemy. He can now justify, without due process, without showing too much of evidence, it starts with destroying go-fast boats, but it could be, you know, snatch and grab operations on Venezuelan soil, and it could escalate all the way up to a prolonged military intervention in the likes of Mexico, which he has threatened in the past.
So will blowing up more boats stop the flow of drugs out of Latin America to the U.S., Europe, and beyond? It might have a short-term impact on the local level, Chris Dalby says, but the drug trade has proven itself to be the most adaptable business on the planet. So it's a sure bet that the criminal gangs will find new routes to ship their product. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
A sick kid can turn a parent's world upside down. Our next guest knows that all too well. Merripee Mills' 13-year-old daughter, Martha, was hospitalized 4 years ago for injuries from a bicycle accident. Martha developed sepsis, but she was not moved to intensive care despite her parents' pleas, and she died in the hospital. Today, a new rule is being rolled out across English hospitals as a direct result of her parents' advocacy. It's called Martha's Rule. I spoke with Martha's mother, Merripee, earlier today. Merripee, I understand that today would have been your daughter's 18th birthday. I am so very sorry for your loss.
Thank you. Yes, it's a difficult day and a very bittersweet thing because obviously we miss her enormously, and this is not the thing we wish we were celebrating today in our family. But I have, together with my husband, we've campaigned for this change in how people are treated in hospitals. It's been piloted in a number, in fact, you know, a decent number, 100, over 100 English hospitals, but now it's going to be rolled out nationally. And yeah, it feels like an achievement and a way to mark her birthday, if not the one that we would obviously hope for.
Of course, bittersweet today, as you said. This rule, Martha's Rule, is now in effect in every hospital in England that provides emergency care. Can you tell me what it is, how it works?
Yeah, so, you know, as you mentioned at the start, my daughter was in hospital with an injury that she should have made a complete recovery from. And 20 years of treating children for that injury at that hospital, no child had ever died. It is a normal part of that injury to contract infections, but Martha had an infection she didn't recover from. And as she got worse and worse, we kept trying to say to the doctors we thought something serious was wrong, and they kept saying this was normal and this was a normal part of the process. And then she died, and we sort of couldn't believe that our voices hadn't been listened to. And what Martha's Rule does is that it provides a safety net for people like us to seek a second opinion, a critical care review from people, doctors or nurses, who have a lot of experience in looking at critically ill people. So they would come and they would do a review and say either this person is fine, or no, this person needs to go to ICU, or they need to go back to surgery, or they need to go to a tertiary unit. So, you know, what we felt was that we were completely powerless when we were in hospital. We didn't have a voice. We kept appealing to the same doctors. We were trying not to annoy them. We were trying to find the right words. Mm. And this allows a kind of ripcord you can pull, almost like an internal 911 number that you can call to get someone to give you a review if you think your family member or you is deteriorating and nobody's listening.
I can't imagine how incredibly frustrating that must feel, to be, you know, screaming to anyone you can about the condition of your daughter and feeling like you were not listened to, and then have such a tragic result. I mean, especially you're a journalist and you're used to asking hard questions, and I imagine talking to authority figures. So I just can't imagine how frustrating that must be.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at the time we were reassured, but we weren't listened to. Everyone just kept saying, no, this is fine. And of course you believe them because they're the doctors, but nobody ever really took on board each time we'd go to a different doctor and say, are you sure this is normal? It was very frustrating and, you know, ultimately fatal.
This rule, Martha's Rule, allows patients, families to talk to a different doctor. But you said, you know, you tried to get people to listen and you're not listened to. So what is the evidence or what have these pilots shown about whether a second set of ears really does hear patients and their families better?
Well, crucially, the critical care review would call for a different team, someone from outside the particular ward where someone was treated. So it's kind of completely fresh eyes, which helps because what happened with Martha was a kind of team blindness set in where everyone just agreed with each other around the place. And, you know, knowing how ill Martha was afterwards, the critical care, the ITU team said that if they'd seen Martha, if they'd been called to see her at any point in the few days before they died, she 100% would have been transferred to ITU. 100%, they said.
I'm curious, from your perspective, what it was like to move into this role of advocate pushing for this rule after suffering such an immense personal loss.
I didn't come out thinking immediately, I must fight for change. I mean, I was immediately furious beyond measure. And I work for The Guardian, and I did think I'm going to write about this in The Guardian because that is the one thing I can do is expose how terrible the treatment was. But after I did that, I was contacted by Guardian readers in Australia, where there's something called Ryan's Rule, a similar story where a parent wasn't listened to. The parent said if there was a crack, their son fell through it. And some nurses in Australia, it's actually just in Queensland, Australia, wrote to me and said, it sounds like you need a Martha's Rule in the UK. And that's really what got me thinking. Mm. And on 2 years after Martha's death, in fact, 2 years ago today.
What was the skepticism that you heard? I mean, I'm wondering if doctors didn't like a feeling of being second guessed or if there were other concerns.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, doctors are conservative with a small c. You know, they don't like change, and often different patient safety measures, things that are now completely taken for granted, like surgical checklists, were fought when they first happened. And they don't like to have the authority question. I mean, I'm making a generalization, but that culturally, I think that is true. And I think they thought, we're overrun, this is going to make it worse. And none of that has proved to be the case. So I think that they have been reassured. And beyond that, it creates a kind of cultural change, I think.
Yeah.
It sort of creates a more equal relationship between doctor and patient. You can often feel very powerless and scared when you're in hospital. And it does help level the playing field and make doctor and patient more equal.
Mary P, I don't want to let you go without hearing a bit more about who Martha was. We've talked about her from the perspective of loss, but this would have been her 18th birthday, as we've said, and I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit more about who she was as a person and what your hopes and dreams would have been for her on her 18th birthday.
In some ways, this is always the hardest question to answer because it's very hard to sum her up in, you know, a sort of pithy answer. She was super clever, always had her head in a book, very quietly witty, really very funny, loved her sister, was a dream to parent, really on the cusp of her life. And it was taken away from her. And I would have loved to have seen the woman that she became because she was just such a pleasure to be around every day.
Mary P. Mills, thank you so much for talking with us about your daughter and Martha's Rule.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mary P. spoke to us today as Martha's Rule takes effect in every acute care hospital in England. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek has been walking from Ethiopia to Chile for his Out of Eden walk, but recently encountered a problem. You can't walk from Asia to North America because there's an ocean in the way. So in keeping with the spirit of this project, he hailed a ride on a cargo ship. So, Paul, ancient humans actually, of course, crossed from Russia to Alaska across a frozen land bridge that no longer exists. You decided not to try to walk through Russia. Is that because of Russia's war with Ukraine, I'm guessing?
Yes, Carolyn. Unfortunately, I had been actually invested quite a bit of energy in planning the walk through Siberia. I was looking forward to it literally for years and had set up even Russian walking partners to join me. But the invasion of Ukraine did, in fact, put the kibosh on that idea, and I had to make a big U-turn in northeastern China and walk, I don't know, about 400 miles back to the sea in order to catch a container ship eventually.
Oh, wow.
From Japan. Yeah.
So even if you had been able to walk across Russia, the land bridge through the Bering Strait that ancient humans crossed no longer exists. So you would have needed to get on a ship or a plane anyway to get into North America. You crossed via container ship. How did you end up on a container ship of all things?
Well, I figured that ancient humans also used sea vessels of some sort. So my task then became to find the modern equivalent. And there wasn't really much to choose from. If I don't want to fly, I have to go by sea vessel. So there are passenger ships, cruise liners. But I thought a cargo ship would be more apropos for my project, which talking about time, talks about both the ancient world and the modern world. And I was just curious to get on one of these cargo vessels that carry the vast bulk of our consumer goods for us across the oceans.
Yeah, describe the ship for us. How many containers are on this thing?
It was by today's standards, incredibly, it's kind of a medium-sized container ship. It was more than 300 meters long. That's 3 football fields. It was 88 stories high. The bridge was about, 80 feet off the sea level. And it carried more than 7,000 containers. It was called the Wow. San Vicente by the Maersk Company, a big international shipping company.
And I'm curious about the sailors on the ship, the crew. Are they, all from a similar place, or were there folks from all over on the ship?
Interestingly, these vessels are kind of, if you will, the workhorses or the modern camels of globalization, of the modern Silk Road. And just as it was back in the day with the Silk Road, the crews on this vessel were very polyglot, very international. Some of the officers were from Eastern Europe. Some of the engineers and navigators were from the Philippines. There were a crew from India. So very, very international, kind of a microcosm of globalization itself.
And what's the lingua franca on the ship? Is it English?
It's English. Yeah, that remains the international language of maritime navigation.
And these sailors, I'm assuming, only have each other to interact with for months at a time between shore stops. Did you get any impression of what that's like?
I did, because this passage took about 11 days and covered about 4,300 miles. Huge, huge stretch of ocean. The Pacific is one of the biggest. Yeah. And this crew of 21 men. Now, more women are entering this field, but primarily it remains men who staff and crew these boats, live a very incredible, unseen kind of insular life, right? They're kind of bottled up on these gigantic ships, and there are thousands of these ships plying the oceans at all the time, and they're a small community. They get along with each other.
And I'm wondering if they had any interesting ways to stay occupied on the ship when they weren't working.
So, it was both this combination of an ancient, seafarer subculture with things taking watch, see in movies from, hundreds of years ago, it's your time to turn to be on watch on a sailing boat. And, these are 6 to 8 hour stretches where you're on duty. Mm-hmm. That still holds on these big, steaming warehouses. And on their spare time, they had a recreation room. They sang karaoke. They played ping pong. There was a rudimentary weight room. And they had limited access to the internet, which was interesting. And there was a reason why this they had Starlink, which meant unlimited access. But the captain and many companies restrict total access, because otherwise these gentlemen stay in their rooms and don't interact socially, just like we do here on land.
Hmm. I imagine you spent some time kind of looking over the railing of the ship and out into the sea. Was it just this vast, endless sea, or were there other sights along the way?
Well, it was a lot of water and a lot of sky and that level horizon, 360 day after day. And so it took a little getting used to. The ship was always humming a little bit, right? It's got these massive engines. And yeah, we saw things on occasion. We saw pods of whales. We would occasionally see other vessels, not many. But we did see one vessel like ours, a container ship that was on fire. It was burning, sending up a column of black smoke, which is a sobering reminder of, that the sea still rules all.
Did your ship stop and provide assistance, or were others arriving?
Well, yes. You know, the captain said that by kind of maritime law, the closest vessels have to render rescue assistance. And in fact, the crew on that burning ship, which was carrying, I think, electric vehicles and their batteries, caught fire, were evacuated by a nearby ship. And that permitted us to kind of continue sailing on into the Americas.
So they were already getting help.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
You have written about crossing 14 time zones in 11 days on your voyage. I imagine that could be disorienting. What was your relationship with time like during this trip?
You know, I still don't think my melatonin levels have recovered. It's imagine this. You're flying an international flight. You have jet lag, but you only have to accommodate your body and your mind to one new time zone, whether it's, you know, Europe or Africa or whatever. Here, your body's going through a slow kind of elastic band where time is stretched literally day by day. They were changing, you know, we're changing time zones, you know, more than once a day. And that compared with the high latitude where it was white nights, you're familiar with that, right? We're just so far north that there was no sunset, was very disorientating. I had expected foolishly to be able to get a lot of writing done on this passage, but I was so kind of discombobulated by the time change and by the constant light that it was actually kind of hard to concentrate, hard to focus.
Mm. And ships operate 24/7, so time means something very different anyway, because it's a 24/7 operation. People are working weird shifts.
Absolutely. And, you know, I would go up to the deck or to the bridge to kind of, you know, say hello, and there'd be a new shift on duty of new guys. And so, yeah, it's very much constant. Something interesting the captain told me was that the crews are getting smaller, even on these behemothic ships, as the job and the whole seafaring tradition gets more and more robotic. So 20 years ago, there would be 40 guys on this ship. Now there are 20.
National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's always a pleasure.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Torrential rain is driving mass evacuations in Pakistan. Flooding has forced nearly 2 million people from their homes in Punjab province. 850 people have died in Pakistan's floods since mid-June. Many have also died just upstream across the border in India. Indian officials are warning that even more flooding is on the way. That's because India has released water from several dams on rivers that run through both countries. Hassan Khan is a professor of urban and environmental planning at Tufts University.
This area altogether has received significantly higher rainfall than it typically does in this monsoon season. And as a result, we see significantly more water in the rivers flowing through these places. It's also important to recognize, as part of the Indus Water Treaty that currently stands suspended between the two countries, the eastern rivers, Ravi, Satluj, and Bias, have been historically allocated to India. And typically, India has often used all the water in these rivers, which has meant that in Pakistan, these rivers typically run dry. And as a result of that, because for so long these rivers have been dry in Pakistan, people have now started living closer and closer to where, you know, the river would typically flow. So in the riverbed, there's been a lot more, you know, sort of housing developments and even farming. And so it's a combination of all these different factors that has led to the loss of life and property in both countries.
So I understand what you're saying about people building in floodplains and closer to these rivers because they often run dry in Pakistan. But are the dams operating as they are meant to with these releases of water, or is this a problem with the dams?
That's a great question. So the dams, both Pakistan and India operate these dams in a very similar manner. The geography and the hydrology of this area is such that a lot of the river, you know, surface water is generated in 3 or 4 months, right? So you've got basically the high flow season, which really runs from, you know, early spring, so April or May through August or September. And then the river, you know, sort of flow really goes down in the low flow season. So what these dams are typically, both in Pakistan and India, designed to do, the design to operate, is that they store as much water as they can over this high flow season so that then it can be used in the low flow season that happens, you know, October through March. Now, obviously, all these dams have a storage capacity and they can't hold any more water beyond that capacity. Anything beyond that, they have to release through spillways and in some cases, emergency releases to make sure that the dam does not collapse. So that from the Indian side, that is what has happened, is that, you know, the dams have, you know, sort of really reached their capacity and they can't hold anymore.
So it sounds like a complicated picture, but what is the fix here? I mean, is it rejiggering infrastructure to accommodate a heavy rain year like this one? Is it doing more releases earlier in the year?
So some of it is just that climate, because of climate change, you know, we're going to see a lot more extreme events with more frequency and higher magnitude in the future. So this is aggravating the problem. But a big thing, a big sort of solution to this problem is early warning systems and consistent data sharing between the two countries. So as part of the Indus Water Treaty that was signed between Pakistan and India, both countries were supposed to share regularly data on water releases, water flows. India earlier this year suspended the water treaty and as part of that also suspended data sharing. Now, in this season, India has communicated to Pakistan about some of the releases, but that has not come through sort of the Indus Water Commission channel that had been established in the treaty. That came through the High Commission. And Pakistan contends that that was not enough information or enough of a, you know, sort of a lead time for Pakistan to prepare accordingly.
Does that mean that there were not evacuation orders issued for some of these areas that flooded before they did so?
Pakistan contends that it wasn't as early or as detailed notification that it received that it would then be able to prepare accordingly. So, yes.
Mm. We've been focusing on the dams as a infrastructure issue, but it sounds like also people building in floodplains in Pakistan is part of the problem, too.
Absolutely. And this was true not just on the eastern rivers, but also on some of the other rivers within Pakistan. Earlier in this season, actually, there was flooding on the Sawat River, which is on the western side of Pakistan. And there, again, a big reason for the damages was that a lot of construction in floodplains and in some cases right next to riverbeds, which led to a lot of loss of life. So this is something that is absolutely part of the problem in Pakistan.
It strikes me there are a lot of climate impacts, shall we say, that are like this, where the negative impacts are a combination of development, infrastructure, lack of proper early warning. So it's not one issue. It is many playing together to make these things so devastating.
Absolutely. And this is true all over the world. Climate change is a threat multiplier. It often sort of takes the, you know, sort of impacts and amplifies them in many places. It's not as if no impacts occur and then climate change, you know, creates those impacts. It really sort of aggravates the vulnerabilities that different regions are already facing.
Hassan Khan is a professor of urban and environmental planning at Tufts University. The cleanup of the Seine River in Paris was a major storyline from last summer's Olympics. Olympic organizers and the city of Paris spent more than $1 billion making the river clean enough for the world's top swimmers to compete there. This summer, the river's open to the public. More than 100,000 swimmers have taken a dip. And now people in the UK are eyeing the Seine and asking, what about our famous big river? The world's Bianca Hillier has the story.
Elite swimmers are used to spending hours upon hours in the water, but they've never had a swim quite like this.
I don't think it does compare to anything I've done before.
Amber Keegan has represented Great Britain on the world stage. This week, she's one of eight swimmers, including Olympians and world record holders, who are swimming 124 miles of the River Thames.
Being on the boat with the amazing team for several days and getting in and out and in and out of the water is just a completely different kind of both mental and physical challenge. You have time to really start hurting in between swims.
Keegan and her teammates are not doing this relay for a fast time, shiny medal, or even glory. They're doing it to raise awareness about the UK's dirty bathing waters, which they say is a major issue. The charity behind the relay, Surfers Against Sewage, which advocates for oceans and open waters, has been posting updates on Instagram.
This has been a long, hot, dry summer, yet still over 1,000 sewage releases have been made into our bathing waters in July and August alone. This is just not good enough. So during the school holidays, people were swimming in sewage, and we've got to end that.
If the waters were cleaned up, advocates say the river could be used for recreational swimming, boosting moods and activity levels. Clean swimming water could also attract tourists to towns along the Thames. Residents who live along the Thames have been cheering the swimmers on all week. Only one small section of the river is currently listed as a designated bathing water on the UK's government website. That means most of the water the athletes are swimming through has unknown levels of filth. So they're monitoring for things like E. coli, ammonia, and oxygen levels as they go. British Olympian Hector Pardoe had this update from the journey.
We have just skipped out Henley on Thames because it was too polluted and dangerous. We didn't want to get ill. We're trying to send a message here, but we're not wanting to end up in hospital.
So the swimmers got back in the boat and kept going until the water cleared up.
Water apparently is much safer here. I'll give it a quick taste. Water connoisseur. Tastes good.
For the record, Pardo did actually taste the water, and medics are on hand just in case. Dr. Hannah Gillespie checked in from the boat following the swimmers.
I've been looking after everyone. We've been very lucky in that everyone has stayed pretty fit and well. We had some temperatures earlier in the week, some upset tummies, and all have largely resolved.
Pollution ended up kicking them out of the water at least three times during the three-day swim. They finished up swimming just upstream from London this morning before hopping in kayaks for the final miles and ending right in front of the British Parliament. The UK Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs declined an interview request for this story, but a spokesperson said via email that the government has put in place the building blocks to clean up England's rivers, lakes and seas for good. And nearly $140 billion in private investment is in place to upgrade crumbling pipes and halve sewage pollution by 2030. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
It almost made it to its 40th birthday, but now it's falling apart. I'm talking about one of the oldest and biggest icebergs on record. It once weighed a trillion tons, but the megaberg is now less than half its original size. The iceberg, named A23A, initially broke off from an ice shelf in West Antarctica in 1986. It was stuck on the ocean floor in the Weddell Sea for over 30 years before breaking free in 2020. It's drifted into warmer waters that are melting it rapidly. One scientist said he expects it to break into unidentifiable chunks within weeks. Icebergs naturally break off of glaciers, but scientists say Antarctica is spitting ice out faster, likely due to climate change. Since Finland joined NATO in 2023, its military has been making updates, including the removal of swastikas from insignia that appear on Air Force flags. A Finnish Air Force commander says the flags have led to awkward situations with foreign visitors. Finland started using the symbol before it was a widely recognized Nazi emblem, and some say it did not represent a white supremacist ideology back then. But as Finnish historian Teivo Teivainen explains, even that is complicated. He is the author of a new book called History of the Swastika, and he teaches world politics at University of Helsinki. When we talked, he explained how people see the symbol in Finland.
Many in Finland think it has nothing to do with the Nazi symbol. It just looks the same. See, this is what you hear from many Finnish people. It's a bit more complicated than that. But in any case, after the Second World War, where Finland sided with Nazi Germany during the war, the swastikas were taken out of the airplanes themselves. It sort of remained as an emblem, but not very visible. Then in the mid-1950s, there was this kind of mentality, and it's already many years from the war, so let's put swastikas back in the Air Force, not on the planes, but as unit emblems in the five main units of the Air Force. And that's where they have been until now. Now the Air Force announced they're getting rid of the rest of the swastikas.
I understand what you're saying about Finns saying that this is their symbol. It is not the Nazi symbol. It just happens to look exactly the same. However, there has to be an understanding of what it represents to the rest of Europe, the rest of, you know, most of the rest of the world. So that just wasn't a concern?
Well, it seems it wasn't a big concern for the Air Force at that moment in the 1950s. There was a gradual realization that the swastika is not very compatible with Finland's desire to integrate in the Western world, which happened through European Union membership and some other steps. And the latest was NATO membership a couple of years ago.
Right. So fast forward to today, I mentioned that the Air Force commander said the swastika emblem caused, quote, awkward situations with allies. What was he alluding to there?
Perhaps the most visible expression of those awkward moments was in 2021. German Air Force came to train in Finland together with the Finnish Air Force. Everything went very nicely and smoothly. Then comes the final day, and the Germans find out that the Finns are going to put a swastika flag for the final ceremony. And then they were like, look, we Germans, we cannot come if there's a swastika flag. The Finns were saying, well, it doesn't have anything to do with that flag. And the Germans were not convinced, and they didn't come to the final ceremony, which was seen as, at least a diplomatic problem in the moment. So there are situations like this where Finns have been told, like, look, your swastika is really weird, even if you guys think it has nothing to do with the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And by the way, weren't you, Finland, allied with the Nazis?
Fighting alongside the Nazis in World War II.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And moreover, it's become more publicly known that the Swedish nobleman Erik von Rosen, who gave the swastika to the Finnish Air Force in 1918. Finnish Air Force has been saying 1918, look, Hitler sort of invents the swastika in 1920, 2 years after that. So in 1918, it had nothing to do with anything related to the Nazis. But then when you hear that this Swedish guy, the noble Erik von Rosen, of course, he wasn't a Nazi in 1918 because nobody was, but he became a Nazi. He was an ordinary hardcore right winger in 1918 who became a National Socialist in Sweden, personal friend of Adolf Hitler. So these details are also a little bit embarrassing to the Air Force.
And what do you think has finally prompted the Finnish Air Force to do away with the symbol now?
I think the NATO membership is one key issue here.
Mm-hmm.
The integration with the West is now much more deep than before, and there are many more exercises together with NATO partners. So the insignias and emblems of the Finnish military become much more visible to foreigners, and the swastika's awkwardness becomes more visible. So I think that's the main reason there.
So Finland is removing the swastika from its Air Force insignia. Is the country doing anything else to reckon with this part of its past? It's fighting alongside the Nazis in World War II or this anti-Semitism that you've outlined.
Well, the fact of fighting alongside with Nazis in the World War II has been debated publicly and among historians for a long time. So another question is the anti-Semitism. For example, in my book, I pointed out that Mannerheim, Gustav Mannerheim, who's by far always considered the greatest national hero of Finland, leader of Finland both in the Civil War on the side of the Whites and in the Second World War, that he had in some private letters expressed clearly anti-Semitic texts. And since he was also the person who played the key role in establishing the swastika as a symbol both in the Air Force and in the Finnish state, I thought this was an interesting detail. I haven't seen any evidence that he puts the swastika there because he was anti-Semitic. But the fact that he was anti-Semitic and the fact or he had anti-Semitic expressions certainly stirred a lot of debate here. This was even before my book was published. I was seen as throwing dirt on our beloved Marshal Mannerheim, who's the biggest national hero here.
Hmm.
Somehow this anti-Semitism thing here has been perhaps more complicated. People are very hesitant in the public sphere and even among politicians and sometimes among scholars to bring up issues that might make it seem that there was more anti-Semitism in Finland than is generally thought. But I think that is the case.
Teuvo Teivainen is a professor of world politics at the University of Helsinki. He wrote a book on the history of the swastika. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The musician Ghalia Shakir, who's known professionally just as Ghalia, is based in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. But she was born in Damascus, Syria. It has been a long journey, and not just geographically. As she explained on the Movement podcast, which brings us stories of music and migration. During their conversation, host Maclete Hedero asked Ghalia how she got her start in music.
Do you remember the first song that you wrote?
I do. It wasn't a song, it's a piano composition that I actually played at a piano contest. And this contest, the requirements for anyone to get into this contest was you have to have a background on music theory, and I still don't, right? But at the time, I was so desperate. I'm not going to say I snuck in. I kind of did, but don't tell them. I snuck in from the back, and I brought my mom. I'm like, Mom, go and sit. Like, your daughter is about to go on stage. It was a huge ballroom in a hotel, and there's a huge grand piano on stage. And I knew the teacher, and I tapped on her shoulder. I'm like, can I please play my piece? She's like, fine, go. I'm like, okay, thank you. So they didn't even call my name. I was at the end of the list. So after the contest has ended, I immediately just ran on stage, and I sat on the piano. So, like, everybody was like, okay, like, just some chick playing around. I put my glasses down. I was a nerd. I had braces on with glasses. Put my glasses down. And I started. Like, I played the first key. I called that piece The Dream, and it was my first time sharing anything with the public. This was the moment.
How do you explore a song? Like, tell us about what it is to go from like a seed to a full song for you.
With me, it always starts with a beat. Because it goes back to the first instrument that my dad brought home, which is the darbuka, which is an Arabic percussion. And he was obsessed with it. He was raised in a very poor family. So according to him, he used to sell those instruments on the streets to make money to go back home and to provide for his family. So always starts with a beat. Always starts with something like, you know, always starts with this. And then the humming comes in, which is the melody. And then lyrics come when I start sort of activating that process in my head where I'm like, yay, what do we write about now? You know, who are we going to diss? Who are we going to write about?
Who are we going to diss?
Yes.
Wait, so you have dissing songs?
I mean, not literally, but there's a couple of songs where I talk about war and the culture and a bunch of people, you know, in one person.
So what song was that you were just describing?
This song is called Nas, which translates to people. And the song says, everything changes but you. Everything goes and comes but you. You stay the way you are, you never change. I was actually talking about my country. I was actually talking about Syria because it's changed so much with the war and with the pain and everything. And people came and flew and immigrated and all that kind of stuff. But every time I'd go to Syria, everything would seem the same. The love would be there. It's never changed, really, in the heart of it. You can watch the video and you would really think I'm talking about this one person who's in love with a girl, but it was this person who's in love with his country or her country.
I think it was in an interview that I've heard you talk about performing in a hijab.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that it was something unusual in the UAE.
Yeah.
Is that the case?
Yes. Yes. Not just the UAE. It was, I think it was strange for everybody in the Middle East. There's only one other hijabi artist out there. Her name is Nida Sharada. She's Jordanian. And she was in The Voice, I think The Voice Arabia. I think I was 17, typical Friday night, and this show, it started at 8 p.m., and I was there with my parents. And so when Nida first got on TV, I was like, cool, you can do that? Like, I was watching it with my parents, and I'm like, and they were like in awe. They're like, Khada, you can do the same? Like, why don't you do the same? So I was in school still, and everybody would talk about the show, like, hey, did you guys see that hijabi woman? She sounds like an angel. But moral of the story, it was very strange. And, you know, yeah, I mean, you'll find famous tennis players and famous athletes and famous musicians, but singers, I'm pretty sure not. She really inspired me to do this, what I'm doing right now. Like, I never saw myself on TV. Never occurred to me that I can be an artist in public and have fans and you know, travel the world and sing. And it's the idea was never there, you know. But when I saw her on TV, it's like the whole world has changed.
Is it more common now for women composers in the kind of public sphere?
Yeah.
In Abu Dhabi? Like, are you part of a community of women composers, or do you feel like it's something that's kind of still new?
I think we're getting there. It's just a matter of time. It's funny we're talking about this right now, because earlier this morning, I was closing a deal with, I'm writing for other artists, right? And my manager was, you know, discussing how I'm going to be writing, composing, and producing the song. And the guy was like, oh, she's going to do all of that. And my manager goes, yes. You guys came, like, you guys knocked at our door. Like, you guys want her to write you a song, right? And he goes, are you sure that she's not working with anyone? Like, are you sure she's executing the project from A to Z in her studio? And mine goes, like, do you want to go and check it out? So I, not gonna lie, I at that, like, in that moment, I felt a bit offended, because I'm like, you probably wouldn't have asked those questions if it was a guy. You know, it just hurts, right? Because you're like, what more should I do? Like, what more do you guys want me to do to prove that I can do this? But we keep pushing, you know, we never stop. And that's the best part.
That's Khalia singing Lazim Takhtar. She spoke with Makhlit Hedero on the podcast Movement with Makhlit Hedero. The World is a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Find us anytime online and on YouTube. Search for The World News GBH, all one word, and subscribe. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Dodie and Billy Crockett, Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser, and Lynn and Bruce Dayton. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.